I've been asked to talk to you this morning about the emerging discussion about practical theology, its nature, its definition, its relationship to the other theological disciplines, and to do that with special reference to theological education. And I'm going to try to do this in a way somewhat analogous to my remarks yesterday, but also with a special reference to what's in this discussion for students. So we're going to try to cast this out from the angle of student life and student concerns in the context of theological education. The definition of practical theology itself, as you can imagine, is one of the principal objects of concern. Maybe one of the best ways to get into that discussion of this debate over how to define and conceive practical theology is to say something about the theological encyclopedia that we have inherited from our past and which has influenced the way theological education is organized in many places. You have probably heard of Schleiermacher's encyclopedia, his organization of the theological disciplines into philosophical theology, historical theology, and practical theology. That was important, and that was influential, but it was not the only division of the theological sciences and disciplines. Another division began to emerge after Schleiermacher that in fact became even more powerful and influential, and that was the division of the theological disciplines into Bible, church history, theology, sometimes called systematic theology, and then once again, practical theology. And that's probably the division we're most familiar with. It's called the Protestant Quadrivium. And it seems to suggest a flow which also implies a theory-practice model of theological education, where first of all, you get grounded in the classic biblical texts, and then you trace the development of the church's institutional life and theological reflection on these classic texts through church history. And then you examine various ways in which the dogmatic and theological affirmations of the tradition have been tried to be systematized and ordered. That's theology or systematic theology. And then finally, the application of these truths and this theological tradition to contemporary situations, i.e. practical theology. Now, that model of the organization of the theological disciplines is very powerful and still very much alive today, and is in some ways hard to get around. Even when you revise it and tamper with it, you still find yourself using those distinctions. They're obviously serviceable and important in certain respects. Probably they cannot be repudiated, but they may be able to be supplemented. And there may be different angles of vision that you can bring to that traditional and classic Protestant quadrivium. The definition of practical theology, either in Schleiermacher's threefold model or the Protestant quadrivium fourfold model, tended to be very clergy-oriented on the whole. Not exclusively so, but on the whole. By that I mean, it was often captured by what Edward Farley refers to as the clerical paradigm. Practical theology was defined frequently as theological reflection on the acts and roles and offices of the ordained minister. And as I indicated, Edward Farley calls that practical theology under the clerical paradigm. Farley himself has argued for a broadening of that understanding of the special focus of practical theology. I think his broadening is not revolutionary, because I think in many occasions in the development of the Protestant quadrivium, what he is suggesting was in fact what also obtained. He recommends the broadening of practical theology to what he calls the ecclesial paradigm. And then practical theology is theological reflection on the life of the church. Not just what ordained ministers do, but the entire life of the church. Of course, within that would also be theological reflection on the special obligations and roles of the ordained minister. Then, though, there have been those who have proposed that practical theology be broadened even further. Alistair Campbell, I think, first made this proposal in a very stimulating article he wrote in the mid-70s. At that time, he was a professor of practical theology at New College in Edinburgh, since moved to New Zealand. Everybody seems to be getting out of the United Kingdom one way or the other. His proposal was that practical theology should be defined as theological reflection on the total life of the church in its ministry in the world, a kind of a church and world emphasis, which opened up toward a kind of public theology or a public practical theology. Theological reflection on how the church shapes its world around it. Now, even that definition of practical theology was not proposed in such a way as to exclude practical theology under the ecclesial paradigm or practical theology under the clerical paradigm, but to broaden the definition to include an emphasis upon the shaping of the public world. I would say today, much of the practical theology discussion more or less envisions practical theology as theological reflection on the action and praxis of the Christian life in its totality, including the clerical emphasis, the ecclesial emphasis, the inner ecclesial emphasis, and the public emphasis. Nonetheless, though, there's a considerable discussion about its focus and its proper center. This discussion includes a variety of voices, and I'm so pleased that it includes not only people that are associated historically with the practical theological disciplines, such as pastoral care, homiletics, preaching, religious education, missions, social service, church administration, etc. Not only are people out of those disciplines involved in this discussion, but people directly out of the classical disciplines are also now struggling with this question. And it always pleases me to see, to go to meetings and to see practical theologians and systematic theologians sitting across the table more or less as equals. Now, we know that practical theologians are not equal to systematic theologians, but more or less, more or less as colleagues and equals. And I see that happening, and it pleases me since I'm identified as a practical theologian. I'm happy to have the collegiality with a broader range of representatives from different disciplines. Systematic theologians who are making important contributions are people like my colleague David Tracy, Ed Farley, certainly from Vanderbilt, has made important contributions. Hubert Ogden is concerned with this issue from Perkins at Southern Methodist. Tom Ogletree is another person. Lewis Mudge, Dean of San Francisco Theological Seminary, who's kind of in biblical theology and theology in general. All these people are really concerned about this issue in practical theology in the more traditional sense. Certainly James Fowler in religious education and human and faith development at Candler has made important contributions. Don Miller in religious education has made important contributions. James Poling in pastoral care, Don Capps in pastoral care, Charles Gerken in pastoral care. These are all people that are making important contributions to this discussion. And the systematic theologians and the practical theologians are reading each other to some extent on this discussion. And it is an international discussion. One of the advantages of living in Chicago, where I live, is that there's a very important airport there. And if you're traveling in Chicago, you're likely to pass through Chicago sooner or later. That means that it's a good place to drop off and see somebody if you want to see somebody, and we have that happening at Chicago all the time. And I've been contacted over the last decade by people from Germany and New Zealand and South Africa and Holland and England and Canada and Hong Kong and Singapore, scholars who are very much interested in this emerging discussion and who seem to be thinking very similar thoughts around the world. I've been to four international meetings in the last 3 or 4 years in England and Canada and Holland and Germany and consultations in Scotland about this discussion. It is an international discussion. What are some of the common themes that are running through this discussion? Let me list them very quickly before I go on and then give you a class experiment designed to take this practical theology discussion seriously and try to incarnate it into the structure of a class, which I think also has broader curriculum implications. And I'll get to that in a minute. These common themes. Well, I think one of the common themes I've already mentioned, and that is the attempt to define practical theology and to broaden its definition beyond, at least beyond, an exclusive preoccupation with the clerical paradigm. Secondly, there is this, the broadly theological theme in this discussion. And that is the concern to make practical theology, in its various expressions, a genuinely theological enterprise. Here the problem, and this is especially true in practical theology, is to both use but deliver the practical theology disciplines from a preoccupation with its cognate disciplines. In pastoral care, there's been a preoccupation with secular counseling and psychotherapy. We've learned some things from those disciplines, but in some quarters and in some seminaries, pastoral care and pastoral theology is dominated by models from the secular counseling disciplines and psychotherapeutic disciplines. So there's a desire to make the practical, traditional practical theological disciplines genuinely theological. There's another type of preoccupation, though, and that preoccupation is to make theology itself, in its more classical expressions, genuinely practical. To make systematic theology, dogmatic theology, historical theology, biblical theology, something that is discernibly practical. People can make use of, and it can actually touch the lives of people. So there is that general theological concern. Secondly, there is the theory practice concern and theme that runs through these discussions. The theory practice theme implies that there is some dissatisfaction with the Protestant quadrivium, with the organization of the theological disciplines from Bible, church history, theology, with the idea that you finally apply all those things to situations. That theory practice model seems not to be adequate to the actual flow of the way we think theologically and the way in which we act in our ministries. And so there's a struggle to come up with another understanding of the relationship of theory and practice, and that struggle seems to be pointing toward another model that's often referred to as the practice-theory-practice model. You move from practice and reflection on practices and an unearthing of the theory implicit in our unreflected upon practices to a heightened concern with theory and then a return to practice. The third theme that runs through these discussions is a great concern with contextuality. And we seem to be in an epistemological situation today in modern philosophy in general, to be much more aware of how important our contexts are in shaping the way we think. How important our contexts are in shaping the questions that animate our thinking. And how important the contexts were for the formation and the particular way in which some of our classic documents were put together. And so there is that concern about contextuality, the contextuality of theological education, the contextuality of the contemporary church, and the contextuality of the classic documents that we use to ground our faith. Fourthly, I think there's a genuine concern throughout most of this literature with what I call criticality which means that most of this literature, not all, but most of it, has got an apologetic concern. This does not mean that it overlooks the confessional beginning point of all theological reflection, but some of this literature is also interested in how you maximize reasons, especially reasons for actions that might have an impact upon common life in a society, common life in the public world. And then finally, there is a concern with the unity of theology in general and unity of the practical theology disciplines. Starting with the latter, what is pastoral care? Religious education, homiletics, liturgics, just to take four, have to do with one another? Are there common reflective processes that go on there? And in addition, what are those expressions of practical theology, how are they unified, and how can they be seen to be related to systematic theology, historical theology, and biblical theology? Okay, those are the common themes. Now, I would like to confess some of my own convictions about this discussion and illustrate my convictions, or at least try to justify my convictions by some discussion of some concepts from Gadamer, and then to go to my experiment, my class experiment, to illustrate some of my views by this class that I designed, and I think it may help communicate my points a bit better if I develop those two things together. In many ways, the contemporary practical theology discussion parallels some issues that are found in all theological discussions today. I find myself gravitating toward a method which is often referred to as a praxis correlational approach to practical theology. A praxis correlational approach to practical theology believes that theology should be a discipline that correlates interpretations of the Christian message, the theory and practice of the Christian message, with interpretations of the theory and practice of cultural experience. I tend to belong to that perspective, which believes that we start with our confessions, but we are always in a subtle, and sometimes not too subtle, dialogue with all the other interpretations of life which surround us. And that dialogue needs to be open and mutual and critical. We need to correlate both the questions and answers which come from cultural experience with the questions and answers which come from the Christian faith. But a praxis correlational approach emphasizes the fact that we are very much doing our thinking out of a context of practices. And we're interested in what we're really doing, describing what we're doing, and maximizing then, or at least coming to an understanding of the implicit theory that is in our practices. And then the dialogue is, though, it has to do with returning to our classic sources and testing whether or not our practices are the practices that should be there, and testing to see whether or not our theories should that we have there are the theories we should really have. And then that part of the dialogue also moves into a dialogue with contemporary practices and the theories that justify them. That's a variation of a perspective that my colleague David Tracy uses, which is simply called a revised or critical correlational approach. And it's somewhat different than another major alternative perspective in theology today that you might call the narrativist or post-Bardian narrativist approach to theology. The praxis-oriented correlational perspective simply starts with these practices and tries to get to theory through practices, tries to get to dogmatic affirmations through an understanding of the practices that govern our lives or that should govern our lives. Now, with that little declaration of where I come from and what I'm associated with, I would like to kind of justify that a bit and amplify it by looking at some of the concepts from Hans-Georg Gadamer and his hermeneutic theory, which I think is very helpful, especially for one very key issue in this discussion, and that is the theory-practice issue. It's often overlooked that Gadamer's theory of human understanding is closely associated with his understanding of Aristotle's concept of phronesis, or practical wisdom, or practical reason. In fact, Gadamer in one place says that Aristotle's understanding of phronesis is something of a model for understanding. As you probably know, Gadamer believes that understanding is a fundamental, basic ontological category for human beings. We are the creatures who live our lives by trying to interpret signs and symbols, texts, and actions that function like texts. And that's the way we get by. We don't get by on instinct. We don't get by on mathematical calculations in spite of the success of our technologies. We get by basically through interpretation, and interpretation is a practical activity designed to help us orient our lives toward answering the question of what we should do with our lives. So, interpretation, according to Gadamer, is a practical activity. And then he makes this even more important when he talks about the relationship of application to interpretation and understanding. And makes the startling statement, often I think overlooked, that concern with application is not something that comes at the end of the understanding process. We don't understand something first and then go off and try to apply it. He says concern with application dominates the understanding process from the beginning. It's there from the beginning. It kind of goes like this. We're living, we're embedded in the tradition of practices. Some kind of strain or crisis comes and puts those practices and that tradition, this is a very tradition-oriented theory, by the way, puts that tradition of practices in crisis, and then that generates questions. And questions which say, what do we really believe? How should we really organize our practices? How should we order our lives? And what do the ideals and the documents and traditions that contain those ideals really say about what we should be doing? So a concern with application starts the process from the beginning and moves us toward interpretation. And therefore, application is not something that's tacked on at the end, but it runs through the process all the way. Thirdly, then, Gadamer makes the really simple, but then finally very profound statement that all understanding and all interpretation is like a dialogue. It's like a conversation where you, out of your particular tradition, your unique history, and I, out of my unique history, have a conversation where we try to come at some kind of understanding, but an understanding that is achieved out of the particularity of our unique histories. Or even having an interpretive romance with a biblical text is something like a dialogue, where you bring your tradition and the traditions of the communities in which you stand to a dialogue with these texts. And then the conversation goes back and forth, where your pre-understandings and your prejudices are used positively but continuously corrected as you go back and forth trying to comprehend the world of the text that you're trying to understand. So dialogue is practical, interpretation is practical, there's a concern with application from the beginning, and it's like a dialogue. Now, hermeneutic theory has had a lot of impact upon theology over the last 10 to 15 years. But I'm not sure we've fully understood the radical implications of it. And it seems to me that when we do, theology looks a little different. All of theology looks different. Not just practical theology, but all theological reflection looks different. And that it might be useful to supplement the old Protestant quadrivium of theology being divided up into scriptures, church history, theology, and practical theology with another division. Another division that's designed to organize at least the various moments or movements, if you wish, of the theological reflective task. From that perspective, I have dared to refer to theology as a whole now as a kind of fundamental practical theology. And I will try to defend that point of view in a variety of writings over the next few years, and have begun doing that, partially to have a good conversation. By the way, there's something very liberating about understanding scholarship as a conversation. You begin to realize that we very seldom say anything that's definitively true. And if your desire is to nail something down in scholarship that will absolutely be embedded and objectively true and perceived to be so forever and ever, you're likely to meet frustration. But if you have the aspiration of making a contribution which can be part of an ongoing conversation that can help develop deeper understandings and more communal consensus, it liberates you a little bit to say some things that you might not be willing to say if you were out to try to come up with immutable and absolute truth. And it's in that spirit that I suggest we think a little bit about thinking of theology as a whole, as a kind of fundamental practical theology with the following four movements. And I talked about this yesterday before the faculty, but I want to quickly then move into illustration of these movements from the standpoint of the organization of a class and maybe even organization of a curriculum in a way which I did not do yesterday. The four movements are, first of all, theology as descriptive theology. Secondly, theology as historical theology, and thirdly, theology as systematic theology, and then fourthly, theology as strategic practical theology or fully practical theology. And these are the four movements of a fundamental practical theology. When descriptive theology is seen as a practical enterprise, and historical theology is seen as a practical enterprise, and systematic theology is seen as a broadly, somewhat distantiated, but still basically practical enterprise, and strategic practical theology is not the application of something that you've learned from the other three movements, but is the culmination of a concern with application which has been present from the beginning. Now, let me suggest we think about that for a while. And then I'll tell you what I did when I first wrote an article back in 1988 with the title, A Fundamental and Strategic Practical Theology, which will appear in a volume edited by Barbara Wheeler and Ed Farley with the title of The Structure of Theological Knowledge. And I wrote the article kind of developing those four movements. And then after I wrote it, I said, what would this actually mean for teaching? And then I worked with that and designed a few courses in the last two and a half years, which I've taught in Boston and Chicago and Scotland, at least those three places. And it does make a little difference. Let me tell you about that. First of all, what is descriptive theology more in detail? By descriptive theology, I mean taking seriously Gadamer's point that a concern with application dominates interpretation from the beginning. If that's the case, then it's tremendously important to describe both the practices, the theory which justifies the practices, and the questions which come out of crises in our practices, which animate the understanding process. And it's important to give some time to describing those practices, theories, and questions. Describing them is what I call descriptive theology. Now, why call it descriptive theology? Why don't I just call it description? Well, if I just call it description, you might think that I believe that you can describe the practices that were dominating your life before you decided to come to seminary, the theory that justified those practices, and some of the questions that led you to feel you needed to come to seminary. If I said that can be understood only with the word description, you might think that I believed I could describe those practices using just the social sciences, psychology, sociology, maybe some kind of anthropological thick description, but that's not what I believe. I believe you can use psychology, I can believe you can use sociology, and I believe you can use anthropological thick description, but I do not believe you can use them by themselves. From my perspective, they have to be used as sub-moments within a descriptive process that is much richer than that. Here, I use Gadamer once again, to some extent the work of Robert Bella, that talks about hermeneutical social sciences. And the point of both Gadamer and Bella is the social sciences themselves are embedded in traditions. And those traditions always color what the social scientist sees. Every social scientist has a effective history. And Gadamer believes that all effective history is significantly shaped by the classics of a culture. In the case of Western culture, that's got to be seen as significantly scriptures from Jewish and Christian traditions. And that view of the world hovers in the background of every social science descriptive act, even if they're reacting against it. So description itself is kind of a dialogue where your own effective history is in the background, and at the edges of that, at least there's something that fades off into the area of religion. For the person explicitly doing descriptive theology, explicitly utilizing their Christian tradition, they would describe practices in a preliminary way from the standpoint of what they think, at least, the tradition is all about. And they may use psychology, they may use sociology, they may use anthropology, but those are sub-moments within this larger framework. To describe then those practices is the first task of theology. Now, in this particular class that I tried to design, I began to come up with an assignment which reflects those four movements. And I want to tell you what I ask students to do, and I want to place this assignment in the context of these four movements, and then go through the movements more carefully. This was a beginning class, first year ministerial class. Fortunately, it was only a small class, 10 or so students, and to do this kind of thing takes a small class. I asked them to find an issue that probably was central to their reasons for coming to seminary and divinity school. And I wanted them to kind of locate that issue in their own history and a history of their practices. And in order to do that, we had to have an evening together where I simply asked them, why do you think you came to seminary and what do you think was the basic reason why you came? Secondly, though, I asked them to share or make a recording of their own pre-understanding of the answer to this issue. What was their understanding of the way to go in addressing this issue in a preliminary way? Thirdly, then, I asked them to find somebody who was also dealing with this particular issue or in some way had dealt with that issue in the past or who was at least willing to discuss their view of that issue and to interview that person. In one case, The concern was a concern with how the Church of the Brethren could relate to public issues. This particular student was out of that tradition. Another student was concerned about the question of homosexuality. His own experiences in the countercultural era had led him to think this was a major issue that had to be thought through. Another person was concerned with the church's relationship to community organizations and public ministry and shaping the public world. Another person was interested in the relationship of church to mental health, his own experiences in his family and to some extent his own history, wondered what is the relationship of salvation to health. Anyway, they all found somebody to interview who was also dealing with this question. And their task then was to interview that person, determine that person's own history with this question, what the quality and character of their thinking was, keeping their own history with regard to the question and their own pre-understanding alive as they went along. Those three movements, i.e. discovering a personal issue that was also an animating issue about why they came to seminary, understanding their own pre-understanding of that issue, and interviewing somebody and giving a thick description of how that other person dealt with that issue, was part of what I think goes in to descriptive theology. Now, there are many, many methodological issues that we could talk about how a theological horizon can relate to the social sciences and getting a full description of that initial reality. Students do not come to seminary as tabula rasas. They come with a history. And part of what I'm arguing for is taking account of that history and using it in a positive way and doing it early because of its energizing and strengthening potential and because it deepens understanding. But you do not stop with descriptive theology. You use it and you carry it forward. Now, how do we carry it forward in that class? Well, I asked them to choose what I call two guides to the Christian classics. Basically, two books, or maybe two really good articles. The task was not to overwhelm them, but to help them get control over methodological resources. We were doing a lot of other reading in the class as well. They were also addressing some way or other, or could be perceived to be addressing, this issue that they were also dealing with. And their task then was to write a paper where they would then, first of all, identify their issue, identify their own pre-understanding, summarize the interview, and then move into a recounting of these two resources. Now, to some extent, recounting those two resources was something like the act of historical theology. But now historical theology becomes practical as well. But it becomes a bridge between that practical question and a rather thick description of it and the text. Now, when I was in Scotland, I had a slightly older group of people there, and they had some good biblical backgrounds. And so in many instances, the student went straight to the Bible. And I might add, I was very impressed, rather humbling. I don't think we do as well as Chicago with biblical things. In fact, I know we don't do as well as Chicago. Many of these students were quite able to use texts, to place them in their context, to use critical tools, and to bring that question and the thickness of that question right into contact with basic biblical resources. But they had to do that, and do that in such a way as not only to present the point of view of the two texts, but also develop some kind of criticism of those texts. Now, that works better, especially if you're using second-order texts that are commentaries on biblical perspectives. So they not only had to present the guides to the classics or return to the classics themselves, but they had to develop some critical reflection upon the interpretations they were using. Insofar as they moved to that third step, i.e. the criticism, reflective testing on the appropriateness of these interpretations, these diverse interpretations they were dealing with, at least that's roughly analogous to some of the concerns of systematic theology. Now, I'm saying systematic theology is broadly practical, but it also achieves some distance And there's a lot of power in achieving distance. Distance from the particularity of that initial concrete situation which poses the question. Some distance from the context out of which the text originally emerged. Systematic theology tries to show and test the generalizability of that classic witness as far as it can. And asking the student to take some kind of critical perspective on the interpretations that they were using at least begins to emerge or move into some of the kinds of enterprises and exercises that I think systematic theology is all about. But they didn't do it in such a way as to leave the original question. They did it in such a way as to carry the original question with them. And then finally, I asked them to address the paper as a whole and their analysis of these guides to the classics to the person they interviewed and not to me. And to return then to that world that they had gone into deeply in that interview process. And to use that world for the communicative process. And to try to make an contact with the symbols and the metaphors and the narratives that were used by that person. And try to develop a persuasive, convincing mode of approach to that person. If they agreed, they would try to do that persuasively. If they found themselves in tension, they would try to do that persuasively. But they would try to move the person by coming from the world that they went into in historical and systematic theology and return to the world they originally described in the moment of descriptive theology. And they would try to defend that as best they could. Now remember, this is primarily among first-year students, and so they don't have all the tools they really will need to do this task. But part of what I think is important about this is that it helps to identify the tools that they need to get better at. And in fact, our plan now is to ask our students to do this kind of exercise at least twice in their career. Once their first year, and then finally, once again, their third year. And that all the time in between is designed to help them learn how to do that and to do it better. Now notice all the rhetorical issues that come in fully or strategic practical theology. And the entire literature of rhetoric and all kinds of perspectives from communication theory. Narrative theory and metaphor theory and the way in which you move in and out of different kinds of contextualities, all those issues come up in strategic practical theology. Now that's what pastoral care and religious education, homiletics, in many ways is all about, how you communicate between diverse worlds. But to ask them to write the paper back to the person and not for me says, don't write for my world, the right for the world of the person that you're trying to minister to. Now believe me, it gave me plenty to grade. I told them, don't worry, you don't have to write the paper for me. I'll be able to grade the paper. But don't write the paper for me. And then the last thing I asked them to do is that if at all possible, go back to the person you interviewed and have a final conversation. Even let them read the paper if at all possible. And then to carry the dialogue even further between them. Now I'm about to wind up here, and I don't want to say this was a great teaching pedagogical device that I think every class should try to imitate. I consider it a suggestion that seemed to follow from the paper I had previously written when I took that seriously. I do not in any way believe that every class should be taught that way. I do believe that maybe a few classes should be taught that way, and that there should be experts on every faculty which would help students to keep track of that process. And so that when they move to historical theology and get some distance from the original questions that may have animated them, or when they move to systematic theology and gain even more distance, and some of that distance is very appropriate, and when they move to their work in religious education, homiletics, etc., they can have some way of keeping track of the total reflective process that goes into what I call fundamental practical theological reflection. And it might not be bad to do it twice. I have a colleague who says anything that's worth doing once is worth doing twice. I obviously believe that, or I wouldn't have given a lecture yesterday that is so similar to the one I'm giving today. I do believe it's not bad to kind of go over things a couple of times. I've tried to vary it a little bit. If there's some valid validity in this approach, it may not be a bad exercise to do it early in the student's career and to do it once again later as a way of integrating the entire task. It is not something that's in tension with confessional interests. It's not something that contradicts a perspective that takes tradition seriously. It is not in tension in any profound way with fundamental dogmatic interests, but it does contextualize those dogmatic interests and may in fact enhance the way in which we can communicate that concerns about the fundamental affirmations of the faith do touch human life. Answered fundamental questions in the beginning and can be demonstrated to address fundamental questions in the end. Okay, that's my illustration. That's my proposal. But it's not so much a proposal designed to be definitive, but to reflect one way for at least one person that the practical theology discussion is proceeding. I think it'll be around for a while, and I've found it fascinating to be a part of it, and I'm interested in helping extend the range of partners that talk about it. So let me stop there.
We have a few moments for some questions, if there are any.
How was the response of the students to this? And when did you do this, and have you followed up on their theological education since
then? Yes, I know. You always hate to say yes, the response was very good, but I think that it was very good. My colleagues in the ministry program have suggested that we do it again. It's becoming a stable part of the first year program. What is the case is that the people we did the first year are now third year people, and whether or not we'll see the proof of the pudding in their senior papers, and which we have not seen. What was even more encouraging was the Scotland experience, because this was really different for the Scottish students. And I think partially because they may have been a bit older and were able to even go more directly to exegetical approaches and compare commentaries and alternative interpretations of texts, that they really, really came alive. And it was quite different than anything that they had ever done before. And so that seemed to be even more successful in that context.
Did you notice any change of attitude in the students in this process? Guys come in with their own agenda or their own particular interests as to why they're receiving this education and having to deal with another individual and how their attitude might mature, that they're more of a servant type attitude rather than a mastery of the situation. You know, I'm going to get this education and I'm going to straighten things out.
Well, it's certainly they get pretty involved in each other's lives to some extent when they begin to realize that there are 10 people that have really, really different histories as to why they came to seminary and why they decided they wanted to become ministers. There's a certain type of bonding that tends to come from that process as they exchange that. In contrast to what you would think, though, when you would say, well, starting out with all that subjectivity, does that become navel-gazing? Well, actually, it can, but it hasn't in this particular case, because their task was to only get the question and the question to bring it back to resources, which these resources get them out of themselves. Quite frankly, many of them will realize, you know, the question I thought I was asking was really not the question that I was asking. It's kind of like the presenting problem in a counseling or therapy situation. The problem the person tells you they've got when they first come in is generally not the problem they're talking about 2 months later. And so frequently they move on to a deeper, more profound question, and a question that has that is perceived in much more nuanced and sophisticated forms. That's okay too. We grow with our questions like we grow with our answers. And it'll be interesting to see these third-year students now whether they are working with some of the same questions that they worked with in the beginning. My hunch is that many of them will have evolved, and that's fine, but they should be in better shape in asking the question, pursuing reflective theological answers. Well, I'm not so sure I would have, I guess there's a sense in which that is true, but, and then I would say that, but I think it's also the case that we do both our interpretation in communities, and that it's good to read our classic texts as texts that are dealing with contexts that communities are in, and that project answers that are meaningful to communities. And I've had the privilege of studying some congregations recently at some depth, and so I do tend to believe that the interpretive process finally is a communal interpretive process, and it's good to kind of see that. Yes, there's a sense in which we all sit down and read our Bible for ourselves, but there's also a sense in which if we're part of a community, we read the Bible in terms of the issues and themes running through our communities. And then we go back and we look at the texts that have come out of communities which are also dealing with issues and themes. So that twofold contextuality, my context and the original context, my questions and some of the original questions and some of the original answers, to heighten that sensibility, I think, is really crucial. And the people who are able to do that are very good teachers. Well, I don't want to take away the title from anybody who wants it, but I guess I would say sooner or later, whether we take responsibility for context and questions that come out of context, both on the part of reader and both on the part of text, if we don't take responsibility for it directly, we implicitly make some judgments about those things anyway. And so I think you'll be a better theologian if there is a higher degree of contextual awareness about reader and text. And so that's why I think the effort to talk about a fundamental practical theology is simply an effort to maximize the possibility of taking responsibility for things that are implicit anyway. But believe me, I do believe there's a role for distance. And both the distance that the critical historical tools provide us, as well as the distance that systematic concerns about coherence, generalizability, common essential themes. All that kind of attempt to get stability and distance are very important. So I'm not going to say there's no place for systematic theologians. There most definitely is. Yeah.
Okay. All right, we're just about out of time, but there was one more question.
I was going to say, in your spirit of theology, are you moving more toward individualized education, at least individualized supervisory shifts between professors and students or seminarians? Do you see that as being a necessary element?
We'll put it this way. I think it's nice if somebody on a faculty is good at unearthing these questions that students have and putting them in the history of the student's own development. I'd also like to do that in such a way that the student, him or herself, also begins to be aware of the communities they come out of. And so I don't want to end up being individualistic, but I think the capacity to take individual history somewhat more seriously early in the process has power in it.